Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 22nd, 2025, we're delighted to host a discussion on the ethics and impact of true crime podcasting. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend, if you're interested, that you can check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Matthew Cavedon, who is the Robert Poole Fellow in Law and Religion at the Emory University School of Law. Before entering that role, he served for nearly 4 years as a public defender in the northeast of Georgia, representing clients in misdemeanor, felony, and juvenile cases. And I'll leave it to him to introduce our panelists. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. If you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Cavedon, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you very much, Kayla. And thank you to all of you for joining us this afternoon. I would like to introduce our two guests today. David Oscar Marcus is a partner at Marcus Moss LLP. He is also the host of the For the Defense podcast. And then we have with us Alice Sheila Kaur. She is a partner at Hilgers Graben PLLC and the co-host of the Prosecutors podcast. So bringing in two folks who podcast from slightly different perspectives within the true crime space, but both lawyers, both experienced in the courtroom and behind the microphone. So without further ado, let me ask each of you to make, as it were, opening statements. Tell us a little bit about podcasting as a whole, about your involvement in it, and what it's like to be a lawyer who's also engaging in public education about the legal system through podcasting.
Alice, prosecutors get to go first, so I'll let you, the former prosecutor, go first.
Fair enough. I will not do rebuttal, though. Thank you all for joining us here. It's an honor to be on this panel speaking about this, because I think this is a space that could use more intelligent, learned voices. And so I hope as time goes on, we get more learned voices, the kinds that are on this webinar now, and kind of push out the more unethical, more sensational voices. So with that, I went to law school thinking I would do just your typical law career. And that's what I did for about a decade. I practiced in the Department of Justice, both at Maine Justice and then as the U.S. Attorney's Office. The U.S. Attorney's Office is when I switched sides of the house and went from civil practice to criminal prosecution, and absolutely loved the work I was getting to do there. But as many of you probably know from the media you consume, whether it be podcasts or documentaries or, you know, 2020 Dateline types of TV shows, these types of cases that I was working on were the fodder for a lot of entertainment, which is all good and fine until you begin to kind of really listen to what is being portrayed of the legal system and the judicial system, and whether it is simply out of ignorance or wanting to get more clicks or eyes. A lot of the information I was seeing portraying these cases was having the ultimate meta effect of chipping away at trust in the judicial system. And this is such a well-trodden space, the true crime world, that surely what could another podcast do, right? But the more kind of I looked with my co-host, who's also a federal prosecutor, the more we realized there really wasn't a voice from at least the prosecution perspective explaining why certain things happen within a criminal prosecution, from search warrants to reasonable doubt to how evidence comes in or doesn't come in a way that's not sensationalized, but rather more of like a civics lesson, so that the lay people who make up our pool for jurors better understand the very system that's at the core of our democracy. And so as a pure side project fun, my prosecutor friend and I started a podcast, never telling our friends. And it was actually in the midst of COVID. So work was a little bit slow because a lot of the criminal prosecutions were on ice because things had to move to Zoom, which obviously portrayed some potential due process concerns. And so we had a little time on our hands and started a true crime storytelling podcast, but from our perspective as lawyers who practiced in the field. Almost 4.5 years later now, it has blown up into something bigger than we could have ever imagined. And I think part of that is the fact that people do want to know what's going on in their judicial system, and they don't want to just hear the fantastical Hollywood version of real life consequences of the cases around them. And so to this day, we still continue to do that podcast. It spun off to another podcast called Legal Briefs, where we try to cover the more nitty gritty of the law for lay people. And I continue to practice the law, which I think helps them go hand in hand so that media doesn't just become media and the law doesn't just become boring law.
All right, David.
That's wonderful, Alice. And so, you know, I come at it a little differently than Alice, but in many ways, similar types of things. So I've been a criminal defense lawyer my whole career and love trials and am fascinated by high profile trials all the way down to, you know, the run of the mill 2-day felon in possession trial. I just love the art of trying cases. And so also during COVID, when things got a little slow, I said, why don't I start this side project of looking at some of the great trials and great criminal defense lawyers. And so my podcast really focuses on exploring trials from the criminal defense point of view, speaking to criminal defense lawyers in a long form format. So we generally talk for about an hour about one case. And like Al says, there's not much of that out there where there's a in-depth discussion, especially from the lawyer's perspective about what happened in some of these big trials. And so, you know, I do it because I find it fascinating, and it's got a small little niche following, which is fun. And so I really enjoy it and have a lot of fun talking about trials, which I love.
Now, one of our specific discussion focuses for today is on ethics in covering true crime from a podcasting or a popular media type setting. So how is it that podcasters, lawyers or non-lawyers, should talk about cases? David just mentioned covering a lot of cases that are already completed. Obviously, some other coverage concerns cases that are still pending. What are some of the ethical constraints and guidelines that you both think through when you're deciding how you're going to present a case and talk about it, especially to a broader audience?
Alice, you want to go first?
Sure, happy to. So I think this is a very interesting question, especially because in, you know, days of yore, true crime or really just criminal prosecutions in our society were covered by journalists who kind of had a code of ethics. They went to school for it. There were certain gatekeepers who were the publications and the editors, and everyone kind of followed some set of rules. And there was certainly a built into journalism code of ethics. Now, anyone with a microphone, I think, is I am evidence of, if you have a microphone and really a phone or a computer, you can become a quote unquote journalist of these types of stories. We see a lot of media personalities pop up on YouTube, on podcasts, who may have absolutely no legal training, who are reporting on cases in real time. And I think those probably present the most interesting questions because they have the opportunity to really deter, mess with a prosecution or the defense, either one, because they are still active in the courts. And even when we're talking about cases that are historic, are done, there are still ethical implications because they are real people's lives, whether it's the defendant or the victims or the witnesses. They all have lives that have been wrapped up in a very real case that is now kind of the fodder and source of entertainment for the rest of society, which brings with it different ethical concerns. So with that, I think we open up this whole new world of what is ethics in podcasting. And I think Matthew, you were going to say something if you wanted to interject.
I was just going to put another log on the fire, and this is something David can pick up on as well. But I was wondering if you could both comment a little bit on specific cases that have received a lot of coverage. Alice, I know that you've done some writing about Serial and its effect on the Adnan Syed prosecution. We've seen some news recently about the Delphi Murders case out of Indiana and about leaks and things involving podcasting. So I just want to make sure that for our listeners, this is a concrete conversation, not just that these are sorts of things that can happen in the world, but they actually are things that have happened in the podcasting space. So I wanted to put that out there for both of you to assess also.
So I'll just jump in, going all the way back to the 50s, of course, we look at it now in terms of TikTok and Twitter, but trial by newspaper was a real thing back in the 1950s. And in fact, the Sam Shepard case is where it all started. That was at the time, the trial of the century, the biggest murder case ever. And it got reversed by the Supreme Court, a young F. Lee Bailey, his first real case. He took the case, took it all the way to the Supreme Court and got it reversed because of the prejudicial newspaper coverage of the Shepard case. We have, a lot of folks watching right now have never picked up a newspaper in their hands. But back then, that's how everybody got their news. And the coverage was just awful, really prejudicial to the defense. Shepard gets a new trial. In between getting the new trial, Professor, The Fugitive is made, the TV show about the Shepard case. And that really got folks interested in maybe this guy is innocent. And the way F. Lee Bailey tells it, I interviewed him for my podcast, little plug, you can listen to him talk about the Shepard case. The way he talks about it is finally there was some presumption of innocence after The Fugitive airs, because leading up to it, the newspaper articles were so awful, so terrible, and it really prejudiced his client. So to me, there is a real problem going all the way back to trial by newspaper with free trial coverage of a case. And I know Alice comes at it a little differently from the conviction and the post-trial coverage, and I'm sure we'll get into it a little, but from my perspective as a criminal defense lawyer and making sure the rights of the defendant are protected, you have to be careful about the pretrial publicity. There aren't many pretrial publicity problems with claiming people are innocent. It's typically the other way around and really prejudicing a defendant.
Yeah, and I think, even though we're coming from different sides of the aisle, David and I are completely aligned in that ethical reporting, whether in pretrial or post-conviction, are so important because both sides of the V are charged with vigorous advocacy so that we reach justice. We always say that whether people ultimately believe it or not, prosecutors are not supposed to try to win cases. They're supposed to do justice. But with that said, we've already seen, whether in the 50s or even today, the ability for unethical reporting to truly hinder reaching justice. I'll give an example of a recent case that was in the midst of trial, all from pretrial and just reached post-trial stage. You mentioned the Delphi murders. So those of you who may not be familiar with this, this was a very widely reported on case for the past 5 years. In 2017, in February, two young girls, a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old, Abby and Liberty, were going for a walk on a public trail. It was like a snow day. And so the kids went on a walk in the middle of the day, public trail, broad daylight. And they were missing within an hour of supposed to be picked up. And ultimately, their bodies were found in a horrific shape after having been murdered. The case was pretty cold for several years, about 5 years, before an arrest was made. And then the trial of the criminal defendant was this past few months. Now, why this is important is obviously this is one of those horrific cases that you understand why it would grip everyone's most inner fears. Young girls who are doing what young kids should do, play outside, are met with the most gruesome end. But ultimately, because of kind of all these faux reporters online, Redditors on Facebook, on YouTube, there was a lot of armchair detecting that ultimately led to real life prosecutions of people who had nothing to do with the case, who ultimately witnessed tampered. That's just, I mean, you can see how that can really hinder the prosecution system. We're talking about a YouTuber who ultimately is facing, I think, 15 or 16 different counts of witness tampering and witness intimidation. This person actually has nothing to do with the actual case. I don't think they live in Indiana. You know, this is what can happen with this unethical reporting. And obviously none of us want our witnesses to be tampered with or to be intimidated. And you can see how that can have ultimately a chilling effect for witnesses to come forward, which could really hamper law enforcement's ability to get useful information from witnesses to help solve their cases. And another way of thinking about it, not just complete outsiders who are reporting on true crime, but when you have kind of these outlets that are able to talk about or give fire to conspiracy theories. Everyone loves a good conspiracy theory. I think that's where good movies come from. And there's nothing wrong with a fiction that you like to enjoy for your bedtime reading. But when we begin to look at cases like the Karen Reed case recently went to trial earlier this year as well. It was, it depends who you ask, it was either a hit and run manslaughter murder, or it was a massive conspiracy of Boston police officers containing 20 to 30 different members of the police department who covered up the death of a fellow law enforcement officer and framed his girlfriend. Those are wildly different views of the same case. But if you have kind of podcasters and media personalities pushing for a theory that may or may not have any basis in evidence, we begin to erode at that trust in our law enforcement, in our judicial system. Doesn't mean that law enforcement corruption doesn't exist. But when you have case after case where people who may not actually know what they are talking about or care about how the truth matches up with facts or their theories, you begin to see an erosion of the justice system that I think has real life effects.
You know, David, this sounds like quite a hornet's nest for lawyers now, and lawyers may have a case that winds up attracting public attention, be it more conventional from the media, be it discussion online on social media, or maybe the full-blown scrutiny of, say, a podcast. Let me start with David and then Alice, if you'd like to add. How do lawyers, who I think are most of our listeners today, play defense or appropriately interact with those outside forces? How do they talk to juries intelligently who may have been exposed to information about a case? What are some of the things ethically and professionally that lawyers should be aware of, given that this is the world in which we're practicing law nowadays?
Yeah, it's a really important question. In the old days, you know, lawyers could say, and Edward Bennett Williams, the greatest trial lawyer ever, used to say, listen, I'm going to only try my case in the courtroom. I'm not going to speak to the press. I'm not going to deal with the press. I don't think that's doable today. You have to defend your client in the courtroom and in the court of public opinion. You have to do both if you're going to be a zealous advocate for your client, and your clients want it. The problem, I think, is there's all sorts of minefields out there for the lawyer to navigate. And many of them have come out of the Shepard case, which was meant to curb sort of the prosecution from speaking to the press and pretrial publicity, and is now being used as a sword by the government against defense lawyers from speaking. And so a lot of times what happens is, and you see this every day now, prosecutors have their own press division. The Southern District of New York is now infamous for its press conferences upon arrest. They have these huge blowups. They have graphics. They issue press releases. They have press conferences. And then after they do that, and it's time for the defense to respond, they move for gag orders to try to keep the defense quiet. There are local rules saying what the defense attorney can and can't say, most of the time, very little. And so defense lawyers can get in trouble for speaking to podcasters, for speaking to the media. So, and every local rule is different. You have to be really careful about what the local rules say. But they do permit the prosecutors to have these sort of initial conferences. And so what are the prosecutors doing nowadays? they're including these long speaking indictments, not just speaking anymore, show and tell indictments. You saw it in the Menendez trial where you saw pictures of the gold bars. And there's been some pushback now by judges and by defense lawyers saying, listen, these press conferences are really prejudicing the defense and we should be able to speak back. So I'm not sure that answers your question in terms of what defense lawyers can and can't do, because it's so complicated. But we get requests from podcasters all the time to go on and talk about cases pre-trial. To me, that's so dangerous for lots of reasons. One, you commit yourself sometimes before you know all the facts, which is really, really bad for you, you know, you and your client. Podcasters aren't looking to make the defendant and his lawyer look good. They're trying most of the time to get a gotcha moment and make them look bad. And you see that quite frequently. You saw it in the Adelson case in Tallahassee with some of the pretrial podcasting going on. So you have to be really sure about who your podcaster is, whether you trust them, how you're going to speak, what your talking points are. And you can get into a whole lot of trouble if you're not used to doing press and media. So it's both tactically important to be ready, but also ethically important to do it the right way and not jam up your client or jam yourself up with the court.
Yeah, I'd have to completely agree with David right there. That's very good legal advice. despite the fact that both of us have podcasts, I think I completely agree with him. If you are in the middle of a case and it's your client, I would really, really caution you in terms of what types of interviews you give, whichever side you are, prosecutor or defense, because it is wrought with just a lot of potential pitfalls. With that said, and I tend to err on the side of staying as far away from the line as possible. If it's a case that I'm even remotely connected to, if I worked on the case, am working on the case, anything like that, I just don't speak to the press. And the press now includes podcasters and YouTubers. I think that's the safest route. With that said, that's clearly not the path that a lot of people are taking. Some of the cases that I just mentioned, both Delphi and Karen Reed, their defense, and some would say very successfully did so, were all over the media pre-trial, because I would say from my perspective, the evidence was pretty stacked against their client, and going the court of public opinion probably was their best route. Now, I think they had very different outcomes, and you need to, I will say for both of them, it was rot. There were a lot of smackdowns by the courts. So don't just look at what's happening in the media, look at the judicial opinions, because at the end of the day, we as lawyers, we are presenting to the court, and I would rather that the judge have a high opinion of me than all of the podcasting world think what a cool lawyer I am. And we should all keep that in mind, because first and foremost, we have our duty to our client and we have our duty to the oath that we took in the office. But those are two examples where the attorneys decided to go to the media pretrial and were very public out there. You need to make sure you consult with your bar, your bar represented a lot. You also have to make sure that your client's okay with it. That's another thing, is it's going to differ client to client what you're able to talk about. What may be a little trickier is when you're asked to be a legal commentator on a case that you're not working on, that's perhaps pending. I think that comes a little bit more hairy, because you're not obliged to stay out of the media on those cases. It's not your client, but they are pending cases. And I like to think of all of us as being part of a corporal bar, right? All of us have a duty to uphold the model rules of ethics, and we represent our profession wherever we are. And even so, when we are just commenting on a case we're not working on a podcast, maybe even if only 100 people listen to it. In those instances, I think we really have to ask ourselves, how am I making sure to uphold all of those ethical duties I have as an attorney, as if I were representing them, as I speak about the case, recognizing that people are now looking to me as an expert because they call you the legal commentator. A lot of the rest of society may not recognize that just because I'm not working on a case, I don't have some insight. They look at a lawyer who's commenting on a case and they assume they have insight and knowledge, and they take what you say as gospel. That can also get you in trouble, even if you are not before the judge in that specific case.
You know, can I just jump in real quick? I'm sorry, Professor. So, you know, I wish there were more podcasters and commentators like Alice who are going to be fair and balanced. I think the problem is, you know, we have the Nancy Graces of the world who are, you know, she sort of started this trend of really, really aggressive pro-prosecution shows, podcasts. There are very, very few defense-oriented news coverage, very, very few shows that are from the defense perspective. And so there's lots of these datelines, 2020s, Nancy Graces. And so, you know, the question for the defense lawyer who's not involved in the case, to raise Alice's point, you know, do you go on these shows to try to present the defense perspective? What's happening on a lot of these shows is they'll take a snippet from the direct of a witness that looks really bad and report on that. And they won't talk about any of the cross. They won't talk about any of the defense theories. And so the public is misled into, look at how strong this case is. There's no other way this could happen. When the truth is very different, most of my guests that I've spoken to, and again, of course, this is from the criminal defense perspective, but most of my guests will tell you, you know, they couldn't believe the coverage in their cases. Tom Mesro for Michael Jackson would open the paper every day the next day and see horrible coverage for Jackson. It made it look like he was going to get convicted. The news every night would take, you know, portions of the direct from some witness and make it look like he was going to get convicted. And Mesro came back every day and told, he and Michael Jackson would say, you know, we thought we had a really good day. We thought we won the day. But then when we watch this coverage, it makes it look like we got slaughtered. So, you know, the press has a particular bent. Convictions sell a lot more than acquittals. And so the defense lawyer has a difficult job in making sure that that position gets at least some play out there and not have it all be Nancy Grace breathing down your neck.
One more question I want to put out there, and then I want to open the floor up for questions and answers from the audience as well. But we've talked some about pending cases. We just spent a good amount of time in the trenches of a case that's still coming up. Both of you have also done a different kind of coverage, which is taking older cases that are already done and examining them. What happens ethically in that move? And how does that affect some of the things that we've talked about when you're looking at an older case that may have already been through the entire appellate process or that's maybe still up for post-conviction review? And I know, again, that's something that Alice has written about a few times.
Yeah. So David said something that I think is very, very good advice that it, you know, bears to be underlined. He said that the media will take snippets and take things out of context, which can be wildly misleading. One thing that I think is probably will lead to a better civic body is for all of us, whether lawyers who have podcasts or don't have podcasts, to encourage each other and to encourage others to go to the sources, especially when you're looking at a case that is finished, that has, you know, post-conviction papers filed. You want to look at the cases, the briefs, the actual transcripts from those cases, as opposed to just depending on news coverage for your own research. I will confess, it's easier to just Google a case and look up the first 10 articles that come up. You'll notice that it's going to be very, very difficult to find, say, a case number for any sort of a criminal case, but it's really easy to find the top line clickbait. You know, prosecutor misleads, prosecutor lies, or defense falls flat on their face. But it's really hard to find the docket number so that you can go look up within ECF the briefing on the case, the motions in limine. What are they actually fighting about? Is this actually a gotcha moment? Because one thing that we try to educate people on is the criminal justice system is supposed to be accessible to everyone, not just those who have a law degree. Judges are supposed to write opinions that are accessible to everyone. The problem, of course, is knowing how to interpret those. And so I think in order to ethically report on cases that have, you know, say, the JonBenet Ramsey case. That didn't go to trial, but that is a very famous case that has probably more media coverage than just about any case in my lifetime. But there are police reports that you can go back and read. There's the ransom note you can actually put, lay your eyes on, as opposed to just get some, you know, commentator's take on the handwriting or the words there. Go to the source, first of all, if you're ever going to cover these cases, and start from a blank slate, so to speak. Read those briefings, read the transcripts. And that is boring, to read a transcript without the benefit of hearing people's voices and the nuances of what goes on. But I think that's the only way to bring original coverage. And then I think as lawyers, we also have a special duty and privilege when talking about these cases, not to just talk about them as a fantastical entertainment story. So many people can do that. Leave that to the Hollywood producers, where we can really bring value to our profession and to the understanding of these horrific cases our society, is to insert that legal learning into what we see within the cases. What does it mean to have these standards of proof? Why? More philosophical questions. Why do we have standards of proof? You know, this is a really good question. Everyone's heard reasonable doubt. But when you step back and look at the meta question, why isn't it beyond a shadow of a doubt? Why shouldn't we be convicting people on 100%? That's a valid question to ask that we as lawyers can really bring value to. Why are we, quote unquote, settling for something less than 100%. Well, one of the answers to that is we'll never convict a single person if it's 100%. So there is certainly a give and take within the judicial system. I think when we bring those questions that we were trained to think about in law school, and we probably think about internally all the time as prosecutors and defense lawyers, if we bring that internal dialogue out to the public and start a real discussion about what we want out of the judicial system, that is where we begin to work towards a smarter, body as a whole. Smarter body of people means smarter jurors, means hopefully more justice. And also, I think we begin to push out those unethical podcasters and voices, because what at least I've seen, and I'm curious if David has seen this as well, our podcast, in a lot of ways, it's so academic that I would say it's boring. I would not have bet on us being an entertainment podcast, but people actually crave to be spoken to as adults and not as children. And so much so in the true crime world, because of the weight and implication it has on each of our lives, whether or not we ourselves find ourselves in a criminal courtroom. And so I do actually think there is an appetite for intelligent, legal-based, evidentiary-based discussion over the sensational. But what we've done is we've ceded this space to the sensational.
Yeah. Pause real quick before David begins his response to that. I want to invite the audience at the bottom of your screen using the Q&A feature. It's one of the buttons there at the bottom of Zoom. If you want to start entering some questions, I'll get a cue ready while David is making his response. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So couldn't agree more, Alice, about, wanting, a more in-depth look and academic look. You're right. Reading transcripts for these trials to get ready for these podcasts, most people would think of it as boring. I love it. Right. I get to read these old transcripts or watch, on TV, on YouTube, the old O.J. Simpson trial, which we did a podcast on with Alan Dershowitz, watching him try the glove on and not, people remember if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. But, you can go watch that scene from court. You don't have to watch the recreation on the Bravo network. You can watch the real courtroom scene and debate it and talk about it. What better entertainment is there than that? To me, it's the greatest. And so, but it's also really important, as you say, and by the way, that's, as an aside, why we should have cameras in federal court as well, so that the public has more access to what's going on in our court system, so we can have more intelligent conversations about it. And so that it's not just covered by some TikToker who's in the courtroom reporting on his view of it, as opposed to being able to see it live. I love those questions that Alice raises about why we have such a high burden beyond a reasonable doubt, talking about why it's better for 10 guilty people to go free than one innocent person to be convicted. Those are the types of wonderful questions why we all went to law school, why we love this stuff, why we love what we do, and the basis for the podcast. I think the reason Alice's podcast people like to listen to, I think why people like to listen to mine is because we enjoy what we're talking about. We like what we're doing. And we find it interesting to talk about. It's not just for the headline click, as Alice says, it's to get in depth about what happened during a trial. So to me, that's what's fun. That's what's interesting. And I think, as Alice says, people want to hear about that.
Let me combine a couple of the questions in the queue with the thoughts from both of you. Can you first remind us of the name of each of your podcasts? And then, understanding that there may be a conflict of interest here, can each of you recommend some other podcasts that you think do these things well? In particular, one of our audience members is curious about the basis for David's statement that there aren't a lot of defense-oriented podcasts. Certainly, well, I'll just put that out there, and I'm curious for both of your responses about that. So refresh the audience as the name of your podcast, and if you could talk briefly about some of the other ones that are out there.
Sure. The name of my podcast is For the Defense, and you can tell from the title what perspective I'm coming at it from. Other podcasts that I listen to, I just got turned on to Alice's podcast, which is wonderful. I like a bunch of legal podcasts. So Strict Scrutiny is one that I listen to quite a bit, which is a fun podcast. But I'll tell you, I like to listen to some non-lawyers talk about law stuff. So, for example, Malcolm Gladwell just had a two-part podcast about one of the Varsity Blues cases, which was a lot of fun to listen to. And so, you know, hearing different perspectives on the law is a lot of fun. As to my, I think you asked why I think there aren't a lot of defense oriented podcasts out there. I mean, one of the reasons I started my podcast is I think most of, at least my experience with the podcasting world, came from listening to folks in the true crime space, looking at it from the perspective of law enforcement, and quote unquote, solving crime. And for me, that wasn't as interesting as looking at the trials. And I had never heard podcasts interviewing criminal defense lawyers about their trial. So that's what got me interested in it. And so I thought there was a sort of an empty space for giving the criminal defense lawyer a voice.
And as a follow on to that, do either of you know of any podcasts that focus on judgments, statutes, and courts as well? And I know Alice hasn't gotten her chance to respond to the first question yet.
That focus just on the law. Well, there will be that. That's a good one. I think you'll get more just law-based podcasts rather than criminal law-based podcasts, because there's not that many of us who really want to look at all the statutes. I am one of them who would like to look at it, but none come to mind right now. So I'll say, I've also started listening to David's podcast. Fantastic. Highly recommend it. My podcast is also very descriptive. It's The Prosecutors. That one is our main podcast that looks at case by case. So we've done like the JonBenet Ramsey case, the, you know, Michael Peterson case, kind of the more famous cases you may have heard of. And we do often deep dives into it from a legal perspective, but it's your traditional storytelling one. The other one is called Legal Briefs, The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs, where we look at true crime news and interpret it. That really is where we try to move away from the clickbait. We do everything from interpreting Supreme Court cases, rulings, to pretrial motions being filed in some of these hot cases that are being televised. And people seem to really love understanding what the rules of evidence are that go behind all of the clickbait that they're seeing. And what we always tell people is, as it should be, criminal prosecutions and defenses typically are not gotcha moments every single time something is filed. We want them to be as boring as possible, in the sense that we want law and the facts to bear out at the end of the day, not sensationalism. So that's the goal in court. And that's why if you see clickbait all the time, you should at least have a bit of skepticism when you see so much clickbait around one type of case. I personally think some of the best legal-based podcasts are done by true journalists, not even lawyers. And why that is I think they've been trained in it, and they recognize that the medium that they were trained in, whether it's long-form journalism, you know, reporting for kind of the big historic legacy media outlets, they recognize that more people are now just listening to podcasts rather than picking up a newspaper. And so one of my favorites is by Gilbert King. It's called Bone Valley. It focuses on one particular man, Leo Schofield, and it comes from the angle that he was wrongfully convicted. And I thought it was fantastically done, well-researched. And part of the reason it's so well-researched is he reaches out to many lawyers and he reads all of the original transcripts from the trial and reads all the briefings, and what he doesn't understand, he reaches out to lawyers to understand from a legal perspective what's going on, and he reports it in that manner.
Alice, I think we lost you here real quick, but I actually have a question for David particularly here, which is, you mentioned cameras in the courtroom. In the listener's jurisdiction, it's common for defense counsel to object to cameras in the courtroom, while prosecutors tend to be more permissive about it. Hope we have Alice back. Alice, let me give you the chance to finish your comment if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I was just so excited about selling this other podcast that's not mine that apparently I got kicked off. Anyways, all to say is, with all of that said, even in listening to my podcast, I will say, if something seems like it's too fantastical, stranger than fiction, then take a skeptical look at it and go to other sources. Don't just take one podcast for a voice, because podcasts ultimately at the end of the day really are for entertainment purposes. We try to be as true to the law as possible. And I'd like to say, of course, I'm biased, that we do present the law as the law is written, but you should not only look to one podcast as your main news source.
Now, to pick back up with the question I started posing to David, David mentioned cameras in the courtroom. One of our listeners says that in his jurisdiction, the defense is usually the ones objecting to cameras in the courtroom, whereas the prosecutors tend to be more permissive or enthusiastic about having that. Can you both comment a little bit on that dynamic? Does that prove true in the areas you've practiced in as well? Or why might defense and prosecution have different takes on cameras in the courtroom?
I think the defense lawyers who are still objecting to it are from the old school, right? They're trained on, you don't want your case in the media and so on. I think cameras in the courtroom have changed quite a bit. So in federal court, still nationwide ban on cameras in the courtroom in a criminal case. It just doesn't happen. There's no room for objecting one way or the other, because it's just not going to happen. In Florida, cameras are permitted in the courtroom, and there's no way to keep them out. They're going to happen in the courtroom in state courts in Florida. Other states are different, and there's room for objecting one way or the other. I've seen mixed, depending on the case, about whether lawyers want it or not. To me, I'd rather have more sunshine than less. I think that's better for reporting, and it's better for my client in most cases.
So I'll play devil's advocate here. You know, this is actually an interesting thing. Before podcasting, I think I was completely on the line of, yeah, sure, more cameras. What could be the harm? Everyone should see what's going on. Your courtrooms are supposed to be open. It's supposed to be a high bar to seal a courtroom. So if the public is supposed to have access to the courtroom, sure, let's bring in the cameras. Now, that was my view as a lawyer, as a practicing lawyer even. But as I've covered some of the, you know, hottest cases that have come across, you know, all of our desks in the last 5 years or so, my thinking has now changed, not because I think the courtroom shouldn't be open to the public. My thinking has changed because of the very first question we started with, the ethics of podcasting or ethics of reporting in true crime. I think right now the courts don't know how to deal with this brave new world of reporting, which is to say there is no bar for reporting. Anyone can report. And gag orders, as you had mentioned earlier, were fit for a different time when we had very few media outlets. And if you had a gag order, you could stem kind of the reporting on a case. No such thing now. You can't possibly have a gag order that gags every, you know, YouTuber, every podcaster. And because of that, we have a misfit between how the courts can deal with pre-trial reporting or even during trial reporting, and how people are reporting. I think the problem is we have a lot of unethical reporters that can lead to things like juror intimidation, that can lead to things like witness intimidation. And the other thing is, when we're talking about the heart of true crime, kind of those incredibly violent crimes, those typically are still happening at the state and local courts. They are not happening at the federal level, where there may be more experience dealing with high profile cases. A lot of these massive media covered trials are happening for the first time ever in these small towns. And these courtrooms are not built to accommodate all the media frenzy. They're not built to properly protect jurors or witnesses from the type of media frenzy that is typically only seen in larger cities. And because we don't ever know when these cases will happen, we don't know the capacities of each of these individual, you know, kind of state and local courtrooms and judges and their ability to deal with it. And so, having seen the harm that cameras can do to hurt the defendant or the prosecution or the integrity of the prosecution, until we figure out how to make sure there's ethical reporting, I tend to be very shy of advocating for cameras in the courtroom, purely for trying to protect the judicial system. And this is a really interesting question that bears a lot of debate. We could probably have an entire webinar just on cameras in the courtroom. But I will say that is something that has changed drastically in my viewpoint, just from podcasting and not from practicing.
Have either of you seen some best practices put in place by courts, maybe not specifically with podcasting in mind, but for managing the high profile cases that are drawing public attention, best practices in terms of instructions to attorneys or to talking about juries or anything else to make sure that rights are protected, both of the public to know what's going on and discuss it, but also of the people who are involved in a legal case?
I'm not sure I've seen best practices. I don't know if you have, Alice. We just had probably the biggest one recently in the Trump trial, where, you know, the defendant himself and his lawyer every day after court would go speak to the media after a full day of cameras in the court. And you all remember, you know, the president speaking after his day in court and his lawyer, Todd Blanche, with that scowl on his face behind him standing there. And I interviewed Todd shortly after that trial. And it was interesting, you know, most people who had an inclination not to like Todd and Trump after listening to that said, you know, I really liked Todd Blanche, even though I didn't want to. I really liked him after listening to him on your podcast. So podcasts can have a good effect on the lawyers as well. People who don't want to like a criminal defense lawyer may come away from it liking them. But in terms of best practices, I don't know, Alice, if you've seen any.
Yeah, for the best practices, this is going to go more for the attorneys and the judges in the case rather than just the podcasters covering a case they're not a part of. Is I think when media frenzy descends on a case, judges and lawyers should not act any differently than if no one cared about this case. And I say this because in a couple of the really high profile cases we've touched on today, Adnan Syed, Delphi, for whatever reason, maybe they were trying to shield the criminal defendant or the lawyers from public embarrassment. Many things were done off the record that never should be done off the record. And so we as attorneys, you know, I don't know if there's any judges listening, but don't change the way you typically run your courtroom just because media is in there. Of course, you have to control your courtroom. But in those instances, and I'll say the Delphi murders for an example, there was a lot of in-camera proceedings that ultimately led to the removal of the defense attorneys, which then led to appeals all the way up to the Indiana Supreme Court from the defense attorneys to be reinstated. They were ultimately reinstated, not in small part because all of the in-camera proceedings were off the record and away from sunshine, away from the scrutiny that all judicial proceedings deserve. And those were absolute missteps, I think, in those cases. So if you are a lawyer in a high profile case, make sure that how a case typically runs, that's the way it goes. Go through all of the motions. Just because media is there, if you typically have these types of arguments in open court, have the arguments unless there's some reason to close off the courtroom. Make sure that the court reporter is there. Make sure you're making your record, because ultimately you are trying your case to the appellate court, not to the media. And those are some words of caution in terms of not changing the way we act as lawyers just because there may be a camera in our face. Now, obviously, that goes to only a certain level because we've seen how aggressive some of these cameras can be when they are shoved up into our faces. And it is difficult to think in the moment of how do I act as the best lawyer for my client, even in the midst of kind of all of this media attention.
Let me talk to both of you as podcasters, maybe a little bit more than as lawyers, for a couple of questions here. How confident are either of you about the media landscape improving in the next few years? Do you think things are going to get worse? Are the most sensational voices likely to get weeded out if they run into a scandal or something? Or might we just be stuck with there's going to be a lot of noise and static for a little while and less signal and clarity?
You know, I still trust the media. I still trust the public. I still trust juries. So, you know, maybe I'm too trusting and naive, but I think most of the time juries get it right. I think most of the time our media are acting in good faith and trying to get it right. And judges and prosecutors and defense lawyers, I think most of the time are all trying their best. There is a lot of sensationalism out there. There is a lot of clickbait out there, but I think that's on the fringes, at least the way I see it. So people do get caught up in that kind of thing. In the OJ Simpson trial, people would make fun of Lance Ito for the reason that Al says, because he was doing things that he didn't typically do in trials, and sort of playing to the cameras. And so that gets exposed very quickly and criticized very quickly. And I think that's what you see in some of the questions that we're getting. Yes, you have to keep running the courtroom in the same way so that we can get verdicts that we believe in and trust in.
Yeah, I am the ever optimist. I completely agree with David. I think that's why I continue to podcast. I think maybe that's why David podcasts too, is I truly believe that even if the jury system is flawed, it is the best system we possibly have to hopefully reach justice at the end of the day in our criminal prosecution system. With that said, media and coverage and excitement, if that's the wrong word, but interest in these types of cases are not new and they will never go away, nor should we fight it. Rather, I don't think we should cede the space to only sensationalism, kind of what I said earlier. That's why I'm excited when I hear a podcast like David's, and I'm excited to hear, long form journalism that really digs into the weeds of the evidence by reading the transcript and the briefs. I'm excited about those because it's giving an option of responsible media to consume. And I think within the past few years, even the laity who consumes this, which is a lot of people, it's not just in the United States, it's all around the world. They're becoming more savvy consumers as well. And they are shying away from what we hopefully will become the fringes of irresponsible reporting. And I think if we give people the option of responsible, intelligent reporting, they will gravitate towards it. You're never going to get rid of unethical reporting. That's always been there. It always will be. But hopefully we will stop giving them the clicks and stop giving them the listens so that they are on the fringes and we gravitate towards, you know, responsible voices. And hopefully it's not just a couple voices. My hope is that the majority, you know, more podcasts will come out that cover from this so that you can go to the style that you like, but what you're getting is intelligent reporting.
We have about 5 minutes left. I want to ask another listener question, which is, true crime podcasts are often criticized for sensationalism, but some have successfully raised awareness about unsolved cases or about systematic issues in justice systems. If a podcaster wants to go beyond just reporting and to entertain, but ethically and with an eye to solving problems, how can they have that role of being advocates while still acknowledging and abiding by ethical guidelines in covering issues?
Yeah, really, really good question, right, Alice? I mean, that's what I guess, you know, we struggle with, and what I think there's a line there between staying, you know, ethically about covering a case and crossing over into sensationalism. I mean, you know, you see this in the high profile cases, and I give a lot of credit to folks who want to uncover what really happened, who want to look into a case, who want to interview witnesses. There are no rules out there. So for, you know, the podcasters who are doing it, the reporters who are doing it, it's not like there's a set of rules you can read and say, okay, now, aha, I figured it out. I know where the line is and I know how to do it. So it's not an easy question to answer. It's a very tricky question to answer. And it takes a lot of thought and to do it the right way. I mean, I'm not, with 5 minutes left, it's hard to say here are the 10 go by rules on how to cover a case. That's not doable.
Now, I will say real quick for listeners who are interested, the American standards for the criminal defense function and the prosecution function, both do have guidelines on speaking to the media and on what is professional in that context. So those are on the ABA's website. If any listen.
It looks like we lost Matt.
Okay. I'm still here. If you guys can hear me, I will just end with this, less on the substance and more of the form. Real good storytelling in all of these cases are stranger than fiction, right? The reason I think true crime draws so much attention, it's not because the reason we love true crime is it's an anomaly. It's an aberration of what we find to be a structure within a society. It is chaos where there should not be any chaos. And because of that, we naturally are drawn to it. That's why our heads naturally turn towards a car crash or an ambulance as it's rushing by, because it is out of the norm. So because of that, we are already covering cases that on their own are going to be incredibly sensational. You don't have to add sensation to it. So in order to stay on that ethical line, I would tell you to look at what you have before you and work on your storytelling, because the story before you, I bet you the real facts are already so incredible. And I mean that in the sense of they don't happen every day. So it's your way of storytelling that can bring out that story without adding an element that is not present, to add the conspiratorial element that may not actually exist or be based within evidence. You don't need to lean on those crutches in order to tell an incredible story. And by sticking to the evidence, I think you can make sure to stick on the side of ethical reporting.
All right, just the facts. What a place to end. Thank you all very much for your attention. Kayla, I'm not sure if you have any closing words on behalf of the Federalist Society.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to our panel for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking this section of your afternoons and sharing your valuable expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.